Welcome to another Bible lesson brought to you by the Hamilton Church of Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 13 and 14, "But if there be no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen? And if Christ be not risen, then is our preaching vain, and your faith is also vain." So we see here that the hub of Christianity must be that we believe that Christ resurrected from the grave. And as he was resurrected, then also we will be resurrected. Otherwise, if that event did not happen, if he did not resurrect from the grave, then all of our preaching and teaching and practicing is in vain, so far as Christianity goes. So we do believe that this happened. We do believe that he's still alive today in heaven, and that he is reigning there on the right hand of God, and will someday come again to judge the world. We look forward to that time, and that's the time we're going to be resurrected. And after that, the faithful shall be evermore with the Lord. Please join us in our Bible study today.
When life down here is over and work on earth is done, then I'll go see my Jesus beyond the setting sun. My days are hard and weary, but that shall be no more, for I'm going to see my Jesus on the far off shining shore.
And then beyond the setting sun, there is new life for me. Beyond the setting sun, my Jesus I shall see. My life died is over, my work done, it is done. And I can see the Master beyond the setting sun.
For me he said he's coming, I know not when or where, but when I get to heaven, there'll be rejoicing there with my new friends and loved ones. My see.
My life down it is all. My work down it is done.
And I can see the Master
beyond the setting sun.
And I can see the Master
beyond the setting sun.
As we continue our study in the book of Genesis, we're still in the 49th chapter, and we're in the midst of the prophecy given by Jacob about Joseph, and last time we got into the 24th verse. So we'd like to begin reading with verse 22 and read verse through verse 25, and this is the prophecy that Jacob gave about Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him, and shot at him, and hated him. But his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the Almighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Even by the God of thy father, who shall help thee, and by the Almighty, who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessing of the breast and of the womb. So here we see that Joseph is described as a fruitful plant, fruitful bough, even one that's by a well that has a good supply of water, whose branches run over the wall. He also is described as one who has been sorely grieved by the archers. They shot at him. They hated him. This no doubt has reference to his brothers whenever they did what they did and eventually sold him into slavery into Egypt. So Joseph has come through those trying times. But at the present, he is very fruitful. At this time, of course, he's the mighty power in Egypt. He has the power over all this grain distribution that Egypt had as they went through their time of famine. But before that was whenever the archers shot at him, when his brothers treated him so badly. But he says in verse 24, his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. So Joseph came through it all. He had a bow that was stronger than his enemies had. He had arms of his hands that were strong, and they were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. The same God that Jacob served, the same God that Abraham and Isaac served, this was the God that was with Joseph during these times and gave Joseph the victory. All there is a reference made in Genesis 48:15 to the fact that God had fed Jacob all his life unto this day. Here we have the very first time that God is actually referred to as a shepherd and as a stone or a rock. So God would thus both nourish and protect Joseph. Jacob also stressed again that this was the God that was the same God as his God, the God of his fathers. He assured Joseph that God would bless him with the blessings of rain from the heavens and with water from the deep, the water flowing through the pores of the ground beneath his feet. The deep, where T-E-T-H-O-M, is a term referring to waters on or under the earth's surface. He also promised an abundance of healthful offspring of both man and animal. So Joseph is going to be blessed in every way that a person can be blessed. He has strength. He has the ability to defend himself. He has the ability to come through adversity. He has power and wealth. And he's going to have the blessings from heaven. He's going to have the waters. He's going to have the offspring of man and animal to be abundant. And he's going to have the rock-like nature and the shepherd-like nature of God to be with him. He further says in verse 26 in this blessing, the blessings of thy father have prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors under the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of his head of him that was separate from his brethren. So Jacob here also states that he, the father, had been blessed above, so that his blessings have prevailed above the blessings of his progenitors. He claimed that he had more blessings than Abraham and Isaac had, under the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. These blessings flow as far out as the hills would reach, and they would last as long as the hills last. And he called these hills everlasting hills, and this doesn't mean that they never had an end or a beginning. They were formed after the flood, of course, but it means that they were among the most non-movable and non-changeable things we can know. And these blessings were like that Jacob had received. So Jacob is now talking about how he's been blessed. And he says, they shall be on the head of Joseph. These blessings that Jacob had received, he's blessed above his progenitors, but then he would be blessed also on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him which was separate from his brethren. So Joseph is going to receive these same blessings. The blessings which Jacob had experienced would be showered on Joseph and his descendants. Joseph was the one separate from, and the word separate there is from the Hebrew Nazir, N-A-Z-I-R, the same word as used for Nazirite. So he was separate from his brothers and marked out for special distinction and service. So these years that he spent in separation and being in slavery and in prison in Egypt, those were years that paid off in the long run and were continuing to pay off and made him a distinct one in this whole group of nations. And these prophecies were fulfilled in the later histories of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, especially in the tribe of Ephraim. Many of Israel's leaders were from these tribes. Joshua, Deborah, and Samuel were from Ephraim, and Gideon and Jephthah were from Manasseh. Both tribes were strong in war, and their land were fertile and productive. Jeroboam, an Ephraimite, led the rebellion which produced the divided kingdom, and the northern kingdom came to be called alternately by the names of Israel and Ephraim, as the southern kingdom was called by the name of Judah. And it's prophetically significant that Jacob's blessings centered especially on Joseph and Judah, and that these two eventually became the two dominant divisions of Israel. It is further significant that only physical blessings were promised Joseph, whereas spiritual blessings of being the ancestor of Messiah was promised Judah, in addition to physical blessings and political leadership. So if we see this great kingdom of the 12 tribes dividing into two parts, the northern part being led by Ephraim, the southern part by Judah, we can see how that here Judah and Joseph figure very prominently in this, and the prophecy about them given by Jacob lays it all out. Verse 27 gives the prophecy about the final son, Benjamin. Verse 27 says, Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall devour the spoil. So Jacob prophesied that Benjamin would become as a ravening wolf, devouring the prey and dividing the spoil. It seemed like a strange fourth son whom Jacob loved. It was both a warning for Benjamin, bold and strong, successful in warfare, but at the same time it might become cruel and voracious. Both attributes were later very evident in the tribe. In Judges chapters 19, 20, and 21, there is a story of a crime committed by this tribe that was unspeakably horrible. The story tells about savage justice meted out to this tribe, and as a result, the tribe of Benjamin was almost completely wiped out. They were down to 600 men, and they were in hiding, and it's a very fascinating story, but it corresponds to this prophecy talking about them being a nation that would be one like a wolf in the morning devouring the prey, and at night dividing spoil. But also, this prophecy is fulfilled in the character of Saul, who was the first king of Israel. He was a Benjaminite, and his character was very accurately one that corresponded to Jacob's prophecy here. So that is the blessings and prophecy that Jacob has given to his sons. This concludes that. Verse 28 says, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is it that their father spake unto them and blessed them. Everyone according to his blessing, he blessed them. So Jacob here concludes the blessings to his sons, calling them prophetically the 12 tribes of Israel. Even though some of the predictions hardly sounded like blessings, they were intended indirectly to serve as such through warning his sons and their children of those traits and tendencies against which they needed especially to guard. Jacob wasn't really causing anything to happen. He wasn't saying this and his saying would make it happen. He was just prophesying and predicting what would happen. The children of Israel must have read and meditated on these sayings of Jacob many times during the centuries that followed, particularly during their bondage in Egypt and they wandered in the wilderness, clearly they should have proved, and probably did prove, very advantageous to them to know what these prophecies said. Now we read the last five verses of Genesis 49, verses 29 through 33. And he charged them and said unto them, I am to be gathered unto my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite for a possession of a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The purchase of the field and of the cave that is therein was from the children of Heth. And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people. The promise that Jacob had gotten Joseph to give him about being buried in Canaan, he now asked from all his sons that they would bury him with his fathers back in Canaan in the cave which Abraham had purchased years ago for that purpose. Jacob had buried his first wife, Leah, there, and his parents and grandparents were also buried there. It was to be a testimony to all the generations to come that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had faith in God's promise that he would give the land to their seed. He insisted on being buried in that land. So with this last request, Jacob gathered up all of his remaining strength. He pulled his feet back up into the bed to lay down and then to give up his spirit to be gathered unto his people. Not merely to be buried with their bodies, but to join them in their life beyond the grave, awaiting the coming of Messiah and the great resurrection day. So there Jacob is with all of the righteous dead, right along with Abraham, and waiting for the Messiah to come the second time now, and the great resurrection day, that great time of great blessing, that time of great benefit, when we're going to be so glorified in the coming of the Lord. And we today, thousands of years later, who are followers of this same God, look forward to this same benefit that Jacob had, as we will eventually be gathered unto our people. That concludes the 49th chapter of Genesis. We're now ready to begin chapter 50 of the book of Genesis, the last chapter. And in the last chapter of Genesis, we have a record of the burial of Jacob. No other burial in the Bible is given so much long and lengthy detail of an account as this burial of Jacob is given. And this really indicates the importance that was placed on Jacob by God in his plan to redeem mankind. In a very practical way, it emphasizes that when a believer dies, it is appropriate that his body be treated with all due honor and that it be buried in such a way as to give testimony that the one who died believed in the future resurrection of the body and the fulfillment of all of God's promises. So even in death, the body can be a testimony to what this person believed and to what God teaches. And it's significant that nowhere in Scripture is there an example of a believer's body being disposed of by cremation or by any other means other than simple burial. So in Genesis chapter 50, beginning with verses 1 through 3, and Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father, and the physicians embalmed Israel. And 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so were fulfilled the days of those which were embalmed, and the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. So when Jacob's spirit left his body and was taken by the angels unto his people, presumably to Abraham's bosom, as we read in Luke 16:22, Joseph fell down on his father, kissing him and weeping. Even though one may believe confidently in a future life, as Joseph no doubt did, and as Jacob no doubt did, and one knows that he will someday be reunited with his departed loved ones, it is natural and proper that he feel and express a keen sense of sorrow and grief at the loss of the loved one. Death is the great enemy and will one day be completely destroyed, according to Revelation 21, verse 4, so there will be no more sorrow or dying in that heavenly place. But for the present time, however, death is still with us, and death does continue to cause sorrow. We read in 1 Thessalonians 4:13, Nevertheless, we saw not even as others which have no hope. There are people who have no hope. There are others who have no hope of another life after this one, of a resurrection from the dead, to be given a glorious place in heaven. They have no hope like that. Their sorrow is different from that of the people of God. After a little while, Joseph controlled his tears and proceeded with the necessary duties for the dead. As God had promised Jacob, Joseph closed Jacob's eyes in death. In Genesis 46, verses 3 and 4, God spoke to Jacob before he went into Egypt, and he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. So God had told Jacob that this would happen, and here we see that it did happen. We are told that Joseph fell upon his father's face, and wept upon him, and kissed him. This has to be where that was fulfilled. Another scripture that comes to mind here is Genesis 45, verse 28, as Israel was deciding to go into Egypt. And Israel said, It is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. So Jacob wanted to do that before he died. He wanted to go into Egypt and see his son, Joseph, once he learned he was alive, and so is able to fulfill that desire. So in this sense, Jacob died in a contented state. And after Jacob saw Joseph in Egypt, chapter 46, verse 30 says, And Israel said unto Joseph, Now let me die, since I see thy face, because thou art yet alive. So Jacob was now contented, ready to die, although it was several years after that a statement was made that he did die, but he died in a contented state. Nothing is said about the reaction of the other sons when their father died. However, there is no doubt that they all loved him dearly, even if not quite so intensely as Joseph did, and they had to have had similar feelings that Joseph had when he died. It was customary in Egypt to embalm the dead using an elaborate process of alteration and treatment of the body, which ensured that its mummified remains would be preserved almost indefinitely. Joseph had his personal physician undertake this process with his father's body, a process which lasted 40 days. It was also customary in Egypt to have approximately a 70-day period of mourning, especially for a person of national importance, as Jacob had come to be recognized since he was the father of Joseph. Not only because he was Joseph's father, though, but because he had come to be honored in his own right by the Egyptians as a true man of God during the 17 years he lived in their country. The Egyptians themselves joined in the mourning for Jacob. And verse 3 says, The Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Verses 4 through 6 say, And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Lo, I die. In my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan, there shalt thou bury me. Now therefore let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come again. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury thy father, according as he made thee swear. So after the 70-day period of mourning was over, Joseph and his brothers determined to set about obeying their father's request that he be buried, not in Egypt, but in Canaan. This would be easier promised than accomplished. Since the famine was long past, this might be an excellent time for them all to return to Canaan to live. However, the Israelites had proved to be highly productive components of the Egyptian economy, and there might be real resistance to their leaving. Joseph especially was considered indispensable by Pharaoh and his officers. So Joseph, very diplomatically, first gained the support of Pharaoh's officers for his request. He asked them to convey this request to Pharaoh. He assured them the Israelites would all return after the burial was accomplished. Also, he appealed to their strong sense of respect for the dead by pointing out that his father had made them swear a solemn oath to bury him in the grave which he had dug for that purpose back in his homeland of Canaan. Now, the actual cave where these people were buried didn't have to be dug out. It was already there. But each patriarch did have to dig the graves inside the cave for his own personal burial. So Pharaoh could see that the request was well-intentioned, it was reasonable, especially in view of the oath, and so he readily granted permission. And it seemed that he also gave orders that this should be recognized as an official Egyptian state funeral with all due honors accorded to the dead. Verses 7 through 9, and Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. And all the house of Joseph, and his brethren, and his father's house, only their little ones, and their flocks, and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. So the funeral procession consisted not only of Joseph, and his brothers, and their households, only the little ones remained behind in Goshen, as well as the flocks and herds, a fact which assured any Egyptian who might be skeptical that they would come back for sure, but also the servants and elders of Pharaoh's household and all the elders of the land of Egypt. There were many cavalrymen for protection, as well as chariots, probably really wagons. They were used for transportation of food and supplies, and so this made up a tremendous caravan and funeral procession, wending its way up from Egypt, skirting the Red Sea, heading across the Sinai Desert, south of the Dead Sea, then up its eastern shores to the Jordan River. Quite a procession here, coming up from Egypt to bury Jacob. Verses 10 and 11, and they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great and very sore lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians, wherefore the name of it was called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. So the caravan seemed to have stopped just east of the Jordan River at the site known as the threshing floor of Atad. Atad presumably was a man's name. There the whole group carried out a formal 7-day period of mourning. To all appearances, it was an official Egyptian mourning ceremony and was the object of much attention and discussion by the Canaanites of the area. They later, in fact, gave the place the name of Abel Mizraim, which means meadow of the Egyptians, because of this. They may have wondered what a great body of Egyptians were doing there instead of carrying out the funeral in Egypt. However, there is some evidence that Egypt actually may have had some control of this region in those days. Well, we must bring our lesson to a close at this time. Next time, we will begin with the 12th verse of this 50th chapter. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.
Stand along the right, oh, heed the call. Go to work for Jesus, one and all. Fields are waiting for your hands today. Take up your sickles and speed away. Go in the field, see you gathering the ears. Laborers on the floor, his game and laborers. Reapers, the eyes are speeding Jesus. Your help is needing, shall he call in vain, in vain? Go to the gate, you'll bring that call of glory. You'll go to the exploding, and you choose Jesus, Jesus, thing you love for. The Master showing what while the sun is glowing, gather now the greater rain. Jesus will reward for what you do. Life's the crown of glory give to you. Perfect rest when ends life's little day. Reapers, get ready and speed away. Go to the field, you gather in the field. Lay for the floor, it's getting very quick. Reapers, the hours are speeding, Jesus. Your help is needing, shall he call in vain? Go to the field, you'll bring the glory to you. You'll heed his glory, you choose Jesus, Jesus, be you love for. The Master showing what while the sun is glowing, gather now the grain of the rain.
Continuing in the second chapter of Ruth, last time we'd gotten through the 14th verse, and the context of this story is that Ruth is now gleaning the barley in the field of Boaz. Boaz has met her, shown her certain kindnesses, allowed her to come and eat dinner with his servants, and verse 14 says that he reached her parched corn, she did eat, and was sufficed and left. So she ate her meal, got up and left, went back to work. So verse 15 says, And when she was risen up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying,